Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real. 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards. And alongside me today, folks, we've got a Real Leaders Impact Award-winning top impact company, the CEO of Grubb Properties. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. Clay Grubb, all the way from Japan before his big ski day today. Clay, thanks for coming on the show today.
All right, Kevin, thank you for having me. I look forward to spending the next half an hour with you.
So I gotta be honest. So how often are we taking trips to Japan? Is this just like the CEO lifestyle, or is this kind of a one-off trip for you?
Well, my daughter goes to NYU Shanghai. And she and I were spending time in Asia in 2019, had plans in 20. Those all got canceled. And so just getting back to Asia, really, since COVID. I was in China with her in November. And then for her birthday, she asked me to meet her in Japan. So we just did 10 days together. And then I've done a few days of work. And now I'm doing a little quasi-work skiing with some folks that we're doing business with out of Hong Kong.
Hey, nothing wrong with that. And of course, you know, anytime you can work and be flexible in lifestyle, it's just kind of a good life kind of balance to have. Have you always been, interested in the outdoors, an outdoors type of person, snowboarder, skier, water person?
I'm definitely an outdoors person. I grew up on a lake, so I definitely am amphibious to some aspect, do most water sports. And then I have a daughter, obviously, that's very adventuresome. And so just keeping up with her keeps the travel. And I do spend a lot of my time on the road as the CEO of the company, which is just a big part of the job. And so I try to make sure that I don't let the road get me down. So I try to make sure I figure out how to get in a couple of days of fun. Usually try to stay through the weekend where I'm going. And so came for this weekend up to Niseko, and it looks like we got about 20 fresh inches of powder this morning. So looking forward to that.
Nothing wrong with that. Well, I'm sorry to keep you from the fresh powder this morning.
But the lifts don't open for another hour and a half, so we're good.
Okay, so there's my time limit then. And looking forward to having you out there in San Diego. Hopefully we get out, on a nice dawn patrol session here in San Diego. But, I think you kind of made a comment there, grew up on a lake, love to kind of get into the roots, right? The roots of kind of where you come from. Obviously Grubb being a family owned and operated organization. Tell me a little bit about kind of your upbringing and where it was.
Yeah, so I grew up in small town North Carolina, barbecue capital of the world. Lexington Barbecue, I claim is the reason the Cold War ended. Reagan served Gorbachev Lexington Barbecue, and not sure if I got this quote quite right, but I think Gorby said something like, if you got barbecue this good, we can cut a deal.
Nice.
and so it was small town, grew up with a very entrepreneurial family. So business was in the genes, but back then you were more geographically focused. So the family had the trucking company, had the oil company, had a racetrack, had a hotel, had a car dealership, had an airport. Obviously, real estate becomes a part of that. My dad, at 16, really found himself, I believe, as the kind of oldest living male in the family at that point. So was it difficult challenge as he tried to figure out his way as a young entrepreneur. And he eventually saw a real need in the Black community for housing. And back then you had redline neighborhoods. And so, which for those who don't know what redline neighborhoods were, you had maps in these banks, and basically they would draw red lines around the Black neighborhoods and they wouldn't do loans there. And so between 1934 and 1968, 98% of every home loan in America by a federally instituted lending institution went to a white family. And that's created a major divide in the net wealth and the generational progress in much of the Black community. And he saw that as a business opportunity and a way to do something really positive. And so he started building homes in there and realized the only way they could buy them was if he financed them. And so he decided that he would finance them without any markup from what the lending institutions charge, so that the person buying was not penalized by the color of the skin or the location of their home. And we did hundreds of homes like that. And my joke is always the way he's able to justify a not-for-profit finance division was he broke all the child labor laws. So at 12, that's what I did, was collect mortgages after school and in the summers.
Got it. Okay. Well, what an interesting piece of history. And of course, still seeing some of the impact of that today. And so if I've got that right, the redlining and zoning was really, it was designed to kind of assess risk for mortgage lenders, right, in those areas. And the covenants and kind of the ties and who you could lend to, there was discrimination in those areas, as you put it. 98% of the applicants were white who actually received the loans and lending. What is like maybe some of the progress that you saw, in your area, while your kind of business was helping out, black homeowners get these loans?
Right. Yeah. And I would argue, really the New Deal was a New Deal for white people. Until you had the Civil Rights Act of 1968, you can say it was risk, but that really wasn't truthful. We probably did 400 homes or more finance for these Black families, and I think we foreclosed on 6. So our track record was significantly better than any of the federal lending institutions and our success rate. And so, but it was great. I said you had kids going to college, the next generation. My book, Creating the Urban Dream, the first chapter is probably one I'm most proud of. And it tells the story of, my assistant coming in and going, hey, I think it was Ellison McIntosh or somebody like that is coming down to meet with you. And I'm like, oh, no, he can't make his mortgage payment. What's going on? It's like, can't you handle it? And she's like, no, you got to handle it. And I'm like, ah. And I was living in Charlotte at the time and walk into the conference room. And he had his 2 kids and his 3 grandkids. And he had his 360th mortgage check. I didn't realize it was his last check. And he was there owning his house outright. And it was really, really cool and emotional. And of course, I didn't know what to do other than say thank you for the check.
Right. That's funny. And those little stories, just tied into kind of the fabric of America. And it's kind of great to hear those, right from the horse's mouth. And so just out of curiosity, how has the business evolved since then?
Yeah, well, quickly we realized that was not a sustainable future. And obviously, with the Community Reinvestment Act, times have changed dramatically on who can access home loans. Of course, coming out of 08, we basically decided that, we don't discriminate on home loans. We just don't allow anybody to get them. And so that's a different subject altogether. But, it was interesting because we had that capability. We used to do all the mortgages for Habitat and just do them for free because we already had the capability, but we've since moved on. And today, you know, instead of being geographically focused, we're product focused. And coming out of really, I guess probably over 20 years ago, I kind of identified, hey, what is the least cyclical investment we can make in real estate so that we're not riding that boom bust that happens, you know, in this industry. And you know, affordable housing was the obvious one, but the federal government with all the red tape does anything but make affordable housing affordable in America. And that's a subject in, for its own podcast. But we decided, okay, how can we play right up next to that? And what's going to be the greatest need? I use Marion Wright Edelman quote a lot, who's one of the great civil rights leaders. And she used to talk about her father was a preacher in Bennettsville, South Carolina. And he's like, if you focus on where the greatest need is, you'll always have a job. And so she being, you know, who she is, has focused on children and done an incredible job in helping the welfare of children in America. Me being in the real estate business figured out, okay, well, how do I apply that? And so today we really focused on the urban, trying to make urban housing as accessible as we can, and letting these young folks get to places where they can walk to work, they can walk to entertainment, they can get out of the cars. You know, the average American spends over $10,000 a year on a car, and you know, all the other issues that come with cars. You know, and that's a big part of what our culture is at our properties, is pushing cycling and other ways that, you know, not only help economic mobility, but environment, et cetera.
And I've heard you talk about the term economic mobility and more importantly, social mobility, which maybe they kind of go into those two concepts. What do they mean and what's the overall impact they can have?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the housing industry, particularly the multifamily industry, is probably breaking down social mobility better than anything else that happens in this country. You know, we were very much, as zoning came in, very much, hey, this is the white neighborhood, this is the black neighborhood. And today, you know, since the Civil Rights Act, the multifamily industry has been completely colorblind. And so it's, you know, if you've got credit and can pay your rent and enough income, you live here. And so most apartment communities are quite diverse and who lives there. And I would say they get more and more diverse, especially in urban areas. And with that, you definitely create a lot of social mobility. And we've actually taken this to a pretty big extreme. You know, my first luxury building, this was pre our focus today. And we did the first $1 million condos in downtown Charlotte in a what today would be a mid-rise. We called it a high-rise at the time. But we put 14 apartments that were under 200,000 in that same building so we could have some accessibility. And today we have, you know, some set-aside units for folks making below 30% that, you know, are in these same buildings with, you know, where I live. I actually live in one of them. And so it's so social mobility really is that accessibility to having these types of conversations with folks that are entrepreneurial and different than you and have different ideas and that exposure that comes, you know, whether it's, you know, travel, but you get it where you live. And then obviously economic mobility is basically just the ability for folks to change the trajectory of their economic futures. And it's interesting, Charlotte 10 years ago was ranked the lowest city of any for economic mobility, which is where I live. And so the city itself has been really focused on it. And you know, it's interesting to see, you know, education is probably the number one way to create economic mobility. But you know, but then it also, you get strapped with, you know, credit card debt, car loan, and especially today, it's really hard for Americans to graduate from rentals to homeownership. And I think that's a real problem, because I do think the home has been one of the great sources of economic mobility in America.
Well, Clay, thanks for kind of breaking down the overall impact that GRUP properties and real estate alike can have, you know, on the economy. When it comes to just like your day-to-day, though, like, are you talking about these things? I mean, do you consider your culture to be an impact-oriented culture? I mean, when you think about your day-to-day and kind of the work that you do, what are some of your priorities?
Yeah, well, you know, I would say we spend a lot of time thinking about it and working on it. You know, unfortunately, we're in a high interest rate environment, so our day-to-day is survival right now. As you know, the Fed is trying to break the back of inflation, and one third of the inflation is tied to the CPI index, is tied to housing. And so it's a really weird conundrum they've put themselves in, because basically they're raising interest rates to try to cut demand. But what they're doing is they're breaking the back of the supply. And at the end of the day, we know inflation's all about supply and demand. If you got more supply than you have demand, prices go down. You got more demand than you have supply, prices go up. Well, guess what? You know, we've got the pig and the python for America are 16 to 31 year olds. We have more 31 year olds than ever in the history of America, but we have more 16 year olds than we have 31 year olds. And so, you know, that is creating this huge demand. So every day for the last decade, we've created more households than we've created houses. And so that's a basic problem. And as a result, you know, the median price of a home is probably doubled since last 12 to 15 years. I know the price for me just to build an apartment has almost tripled in the last 10 years. And so that's a real problem in America. And we do spend a lot of time thinking about that and talking about that. And, you know, it can be scary in the real estate business. And that's what you got to remember is, hey, this is a long-term investment. And, you know, and it really is about supply and demand.
Interesting. And when you think about like the culture of GRUP as opposed to maybe the other developers that are out there building multifamily properties, is there a difference that sticks out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm real excited. I mean, Culture ID, who does our engagement surveys, just gave us a big award. We again ranked in the top 10% for engagement. And, you know, the first two words of our vision has been working together. And that hasn't changed in, you know, at least two decades or more. It's definitely been over two decades, and we really, really take that to heart. And everybody that comes in, it's, you know, what's most important for GRUP Properties. It's not what's your title, what's your job. You know, my chief construction officer started out as a maintenance supervisor with me in 1992. My chief development officer started out as assistant property manager on apartment community with me in 1994. President of the company started out as a construction project manager in 1995. And so we've all kind of grown up together in the business. And the rest of our team, our new boy on the senior leadership, joined in June of 08. So he still has the new boy title, but we're adding some fresh blood too. But we've all kind of grown up together. We really have this working together concept. In our engagement surveys that we just received back, 99% of our folks said that their immediate team works really well together. And to have 99% of your folks say that, and we probably have 50 different teams, was basically shocking for me to read. I was like, wow, that's pretty amazing. And so I feel very fortunate to be a part of a company with that type of culture.
Well, you know, it seems like the company is, that culture is really attributed to a lot of the growth in the company and, recruited a lot of values aligned individuals who probably share the same values of working together. I'm curious to learn, like, when you think about some of the leadership battles or the difficult moments that, you know, often are between two individuals with a misunderstanding, how have you been able to use leadership and communication to overcome some of those big things? And Clay, I ask this as in, you know, leaders listening to this, looking to kind of get help with being a better leader. When you were kind of faced with a difficult time, maybe there is a moment in time you could share with us today. What was it and how did you overcome it?
Well, yeah, I mean, those are two completely different questions. But, you know, I think in general, there are people that carry their ego with them. And there are folks that are willing to check it at the door. And we have a company where you have to check it at the door. You're not going to win every argument. And, you know, I have a team that makes sure I lose my fair share of arguments. And they know I like to argue. So it's a, it takes a lot of humility to admit you're wrong, and you have to be able to do that if you want to make progress in any kind of environment. And so, you know, as we say, a lot of times it's hard for us to make a decision because we've got a bunch of people with strong opinions arguing about it. But by the time we make a decision, it's usually unanimous, and then there's no having to second guess it from that point forward. I think having a mission, inspirational vision is critical in today's world. We just rolled our new vision out, which is working together, having meaningful impact on America's housing crisis. And we laid that out as our vision for our company. I think that's part of why our engagement surveys were even better this year, despite the challenges being significantly greater right now. And there are immense challenges, you know, when you see interest rates change. You know, we had apartment communities that were selling at 3.5 cap rates. For your folks, that's if you have $3.5 million of net income on apartment community, you divide that by 3.5%, and that says that apartment community is worth $100 million. Well, the Fed is trying to drive down our rental rates. And we've also got pressure on expenses. So that $3.5 million in many markets is moving in the wrong direction. Fortunately, ours continues to march in the right direction, but it's very difficult in this environment. But at the same time, they do that by increasing the cost of capital. So now if your cap rate goes to 5% because interest rates are higher and you still got your same 3.5, if you're lucky, well, your properties dropped from $100 million value to $70 million value. And if you had 50% leverage, $50 million of debt, your equity's gone from $50 million to $20 million. So you've just lost 60% of your equity. And so we're in that environment right now and have been for the last 18 months. And if it was just about the money, it would be really hard to show up to work every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's so important and crucial. And just out of curiosity, like, what's your outlook for the rest of the year when it comes to interest rates?
With interest rates, I think the Fed's going to keep too high too long, and they're going to be caught like they were this last time. And they're going to have to drop them a lot harder and faster than they anticipate a year from now. Now, whether that's 9 months or 15 months, I don't know, but there's a lot of pain in the system. You know, I use the example of your property going from $100 million to $70 million. Well, the reality is if you build in a lot of the overbuilt markets in the Sun Belt, call it Texas, where your $3.5 million of income actually went down to $3 million, and instead of building conservatively with 50% leverage, which we typically use, you could have used 75% leverage. So you got a $75 million loan on your $100 million, but now your $3.5 million is three, and your cap rate is probably higher than five, but we use five because it's easy math. Your property is now only worth $60 million. So you actually owe $15 million to your lender, and 100% of your investment's wiped out. And basically, that is what's happened. And I would say that the majority of properties that are under construction in Texas are under that scenario. And so they're probably looking at their values coming in, you know, some percentage below what they owe. And so you potentially are creating another banking crisis. I mean, obviously, we've already lost three banks as the result of these rapid increases. And the problem is Fed data tends to always focus on rearview mirror as opposed to windshield. And that's why they're late to the game. And that's why you see the cycles move. So, you know, personally, I think, you know, 18 months from now, multifamily is going to be the single best investment that may exist in the world. But for the next 8-12 months, it's like, oof, I got to survive between now and then.
Certainly a lagging indicator. What do you think would be a good solution other than just simply lowering the rates? Is that just the ultimate solution to you?
No, I mean, in fact, I think the rates have, you know, I mean, long-term rates are way more impactful than short-term rates. So I actually have, you know, now I won't say consistent dialogue, but some dialogue with Richmond Fed chairman. And it's hard to, you know, disagree with, hey, the long-term rate's most important. And his comment is, hey, I got limited tools. Well, the reality is that's where, you know, really the federal government should be stepping in, and HUD itself should be stepping up, and as well as, you know, Freddie and Fannie tend to be, you know, really, really helpful in our industry. But the reality is it's all a supply issue. And right now, these high interest rates are breaking the back of the supply chain, and that could be real problematic. We did that in 08, 09, and it took us 10 years to build back the infrastructure that we had pre 08, 09. And so there's a lot of risk that we're starting to break that down today. So, I mean, we really need some real incentives for folks to invest in housing. And for, you know, HUD has, you know, incredible 42-year fixed rate financings for housing. But, you know, my joke is HUD can do in 17 months what any other lender can do in 45 days. And so as a result, it's just, it's really painful getting through that gauntlet to get that kind of financing. And, but it's worth its weight in gold when you get there, and investors then love it, and it's easy to track capital. So there are a lot of things the federal government could be doing, that I think the Fed recognizes, but the problem is the federal government's not doing these things. And so we're in a real quandary because, you know, I'm like, look, you're going to create really long-term inflation if you break the back of our industry right now.
Interesting. And Clay, you know, obviously you have a great pulse on kind of what's going on. You have great experience, you know, over several years being in this industry, looking at rates day after day. But like, where do you go for help? Do you kind of surround yourself around other individuals in this space? Are there channels or news or programs you like to listen to? Where do you kind of go for to get your information and get help?
Yeah, well, I spend a lot of time out in the world, and I find that really beneficial. YPO has played a big role in my life. I have a real estate forum. Actually, I have a U.S.-China forum. So we spend a lot of time on the U.S.-China subject. And with my daughter living in China, obviously, I have a sincere interest there. You know, and I'm even with, I was interested in thinking about it. It's like people are like, well, why did your daughter learn Mandarin. I'm like, well, if the Chinese are going to take over the world, I need an interpreter. And right. And then I was thinking about my son's getting ready to go try to get his master's in entomology. And I'm like, well, with climate change, all these insects are going to be bringing all these different diseases. And good thing I'm going to have an entomologist in the family, too. So, you know, for me, you know, having one of the first things I did, I took over running the company 90 days after 9/11. And one of the very first things I did was switch from a family board to an outside board of directors and a formal board of directors. And that board of directors has the ability to fire me. And we have a extremely diverse board of directors with extremely diverse opinions. You know, I've got I don't need to go into the makeup of my board, but it's been a wonderful group that comes from very different perspectives, very different backgrounds. And, you know, and we're very transparent about what's happening in the markets and helping everybody understand it and having those different perspectives was great. I mean, like when Black Lives Matter happened, I was like, you know, I called, I had a Black female on my board and called her to, you know, just talk. And I'm like, you know, what do I do? You know, everybody's, and she's like, look, Clay, you don't need to do anything. You've been doing this for 50 years. She goes, you just need to tell people what you're already doing and what you have been doing. And, you know, and that's great because that's when you're not doing the reaction du jour. You know, we our last office building was named after the first Black female that was admitted to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and gotten to be very close with her son through this, who I didn't know at the time. And that was all before Black Lives Matter. And she actually, it was interesting, she graduated from high school at 14 as the valedictorian. Went to Johnson C. Smith and graduated as valedictorian from Historic Black College at 18. Ended up going to UC Berkeley to get a master's in Spanish, of all things, and came back and was a professor and decided to go get her PhD at like 28 or 29 in Spanish and showed up at the University of North Carolina after being accepted. And they didn't realize she was Black. And they rescinded her acceptance. And because she was not a young buck anymore, she wasn't going to get pushed around. And so she fought it tooth and nail. And eventually they had to accept her. And so that really started the integration at the University of North Carolina. And so it's a really inspiring history there, and her poetry is amazing. We now have her poetry on her wall, and I actually had dinner with her son. We went to Michael Jackson play together in New York about a month ago, and he's trying to do a I can't remember if it was a rap song or a play. I think it was a rap song around some of the poetry, and it was really great.
Clay, when you think about just like the concept of impact, I mean, obviously this has just been embedded and rooted into your culture, kind of the way of life at the company, the conversations the company has, the values it has and carries, and the proactiveness obviously shows. When you think about impact as a whole, like what does that mean to you exactly? How would you define that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And actually, I you know, talking about resources, I actually just graduated as a finance leadership fellow with the Aspen Institute. And that has been a really amazing, played an amazing role in my view of impact. And Ron G. and Chris, who kind of created this fellowship, I'll credit them a lot. you know, from just like, you know, talking about diversity and your DEI program at your company. Well, the reality is, you know, mandated percentages, we decided, you know, that's probably not a good thing. But mandated amount of percentages for interviews, that's a very good thing. Because you make sure, hey, okay, you had to have interviewed a diverse set of candidates. You still choose the best candidate, but you didn't just hire somebody because, hey, I like the way that person looks, so I want to interview them. You've been forced to interview a number of candidates for a position. And as a result, you know, we have, I think our new hires for the last couple of years have been probably north of 70% female and north of 50% folks represented from minority folks and or roles. But the you know, I think the end of the day, it's, I think impact is really about you know, can you go to bed at night knowing the world's a little better off because of what you're doing?
Yeah, it's powerful. Well, Clay, this has been an interesting and intellectual conversation today. Certainly learning a lot about kind of the current state of the real estate industry and also about the long-term approach that, you know, Grub Properties has taken. So I appreciate your time coming on the program today. Clay, in all of this, what is your definition of a real leader?
My definition of real leader is, I think it's somebody that's inspirational to the folks around them, both because of their actions as well as their vision. And so I think it takes a combination. I always I remember in college, it's like the CEO of Time Warner or something at the time. And I remember him talk about there are dreamers in the world and there's doers in the world. And if you can be a dreamer and a doer, that's where you really set yourself apart in this world.
I love that. Well said. For Clay Grubb, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, inspire more dreamer doers, and always keep it real. Thank you, Clay.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
Hey, Real Leaders, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to realleaders.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.